This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington. President Trump has made many statements about when he wants to reopen the economy, but it's governors who decide when to order people to stay home and when to shut down a local business, and it's governors who decide when it's time to open them back up again. And some states have been hit harder than others, like Washington State, New York, Michigan, California, and Colorado. Colorado's first coronavirus case was a skier on vacation. Now it has at least 2,600 confirmed cases and at least 50 deaths. It was one of the first states to have a drive-through testing site. And now a biotech company in the ski town of Telluride in southwestern Colorado is working on testing all 8,000 residents for the specific COVID-19 antibody. Governor Jared Polis joins us now from Boulder, Colorado, to talk more about what his state is doing to fight coronavirus. Governor, welcome.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on. I wish it was under better circumstances.
So do I, Governor, but it is good to talk to you. You issued a stay-at-home order in Colorado last week. People can go to essential stores, they can help others, they can work in essential industries. But other than that, they're supposed to stay home. Are people complying? What does compliance look like in Colorado now?
You know, by and large, people know that they need to. This is a very blunt instrument. I mean, this is really, you know, horrific to prevent people from being able to earn a living when they need to. But it really is the only way in the short term to be able to really make a difference on slowing the spread. We have over 2,600 people identified with COVID-19 in Colorado, thousands and thousands more that have not been identified. Because frankly, what we tell people, if you show the symptoms, are just stay at home. You don't need to go out and get a test. If you don't need medical attention, you need to just stay at home.
A lot of governors have seemingly struggled with the decision of whether to have a statewide stay-at-home order. Some have been later than others. Take me inside that decision a little bit. Of course, it's a blunt tool. Coronavirus is extremely dangerous. I know it's risk-benefit. These decisions always are. Why have some governors, do you think, prevaricated while others have gone out early?
Well, it's a very difficult thing to do because it basically means you're preventing most people from being able to earn the paycheck that they need to support themselves. One thing that gave me a lot of confidence was that when the federal government acted to send everybody $1,200 per person, $500 per family, for people who are living paycheck to paycheck, that's really a life preserver.
Governor, we had some officials from Crested Butte on this show a couple of weeks ago. For listeners who don't remember, Crested Butte is a little ski town in Gunnison County. Now, they were worried about a coronavirus spread in their area. I think at the time they had 19 cases in a tiny town. They shut things down pretty early, but the mayor pro tem of Crested Butte, a guy named Will Dujardin, told us that their county had some critical needs. Listen.
One, we're trying to get a 12-patient critical care MASH type unit for Gunnison. And then we are also trying to get a disaster medical assistance team for the 6-county western region. We've put that ask out to our, you know, elected officials at the state level and the federal level. And we're basically being told that you're like way down on the list and we're sorry, it might not be happening. So we're just trying to get the word out that we do need help because we know that the cases are rising. So we're doing our best to stay positive and look out for each other. But we do need some serious help here from the feds as soon as possible.
Governor, has that aid or something similar gone to Crested Butte or Gunnison County and the surrounding counties in the western part of your state?
Well, no surprise. The really nexus, the hotspots of the virus in our state are many of our world-class ski resorts in Pitkin and Eagle and Summit County and Gunnison County. The tourists are all gone. And so thankfully, because we have the extra capacity in those hospitals, they haven't yet reached their peak capacity, meaning they normally serve a population 3 or 4 times the current population of those counties because the tourists are all gone. So they have extra capacity, unlike a hospital in New York or Denver or Milwaukee or Chicago, which doesn't have normally they're going to be at 90 to 95% capacity on a normal day. Forget about COVID-19.
Now, how is hospital capacity in Denver right now?
So far, we're holding. We have enough. We have 414 people across the state in hospital beds, right? But what you see with this virus is a lag between when you get it, when you need to be hospitalized. It's about, first of all, 4 or 5 days from exposure to a symptom, and then we're finding it's about an 8-day average from symptoms to hospitalization. So it's really a trailing indicator. So we're not going to see this decrease from the stay-at-home order for another week in our state. We're now seeing a decrease in the rate of the increase because we closed bars and restaurants well over a week ago. So we've gone from it doubling every 1.5 to 2 days to doubling every 5 days. Now, you might call that progress, but doubling every 5 days is still a very scary prospect. It's faster than we can build hospital beds or expand capacity, which is why we're very hopeful the stay-at-home order will reduce that even further.
Now, I want to ask you a little bit more about your stay-at-home order, which right now expires April 11th, right?
Yes.
Are you going to have to go beyond that?
Well, it's quite likely, and we're going to base that decision on the science and the data. The president has said April 30th. We're certainly looking at a broad range of information, but the truth is we simply don't know what it's doing yet because of that 12-day lag effect. We need a few days of data to see how long we need to do it, how well it's working. And we know that we need to take whatever steps we can to allow people to earn a living as soon as we can, so without jeopardizing their lives. So it's that fine balancing act, knowing full well that we don't want to have tens of thousands of lives lost in Colorado, millions in the country. At the same time, we want people to be able to support themselves and go to work and be productive as soon as possible in a safe way. I mean, what I've said is economic productivity is not the enemy here. It's physical proximity. So the extent that we can be productive and support ourselves without having to be near each other. And of course, many people are telecommuting and working, and that's obviously one great way of doing it. But you can't do that for every job. That's what we need to figure out in the coming weeks.
Now, Governor, you mentioned sort of the race here. See if you can flatten the curve enough that hospital capacity in a big city like Denver doesn't get overwhelmed. We've seen images from other big cities building field hospitals, putting 1,000-bed hospitals in convention centers. Do you have those plans in Denver in case demand starts to rise past the number of beds you have?
Yes, we've had the Army Corps of Engineers here for about a week already, helping to build hospital capacity. We've had the National Guard helping with our drive-through testing facilities and logistics around them. But we are planning and moving into the operational phase of expanding the bed capacity, working with our major hospitals as we speak.
Governor, we got this question from a constituent of yours, from Claudia in Green Mountain Falls, Colorado, who wants to ask the governor, why are gun shops classified as essential in this crisis? Are you afraid of outraging gun owners? Because that scares the hell out of me. That's what Claudia says.
Well, you know, what we want to do is make sure as many people comply and stay at home as possible. And that means ensuring public confidence. There was a brief time when one of our cities tried to say they were closing liquor stores the next day, and then everybody rushed out to the liquor stores, creating the very public health problem we were trying to avoid. As long as we can keep it orderly and honor spacing, those kinds of stores are fine to operate. In fact, marijuana dispensaries are also open in Colorado because the last thing we want to do is create a kind of panic situation. We want to make sure that people have what they need to stay at home, go out only for the necessities. And we're saying it's not a contest to see how much you can avoid staying at home and get around the edges of the order. It's a contest to honor the spirit of the order, which is to stay at home at all times unless absolutely necessary.
A lot of people have speculated that governors like you that have a lot of gun owners in your state also just, you have a lot of priorities right now and you have a lot of headaches. Angry gun owners and the NRA is not one that you necessarily want right now. Did that enter into the decision?
Well, it's a public health issue. I mean, obviously guns don't work against the virus, neither does liquor, neither does marijuana. It has nothing to do with that. It has to trying to ensure public confidence and increasing compliance with stay at home by doing that. So I guess you're going to have to look at the social aspects of any society, but it was an easy call in our state that those things are going to be open. People have been quite upset. If you close something like liquor stores, many people have a chemical dependence to alcohol. I mean, you're going to have a lot of problems on your hand. They need to deal with that. They need to address their addiction. Mm-hmm. But it's separate from the public health issue of COVID-19. So we want to instill public confidence. Of course, guns are part of our culture. People use marijuana legally. People use alcohol legally. Any of those things can be used responsibly. Any of those things can be used irresponsibly. Alcohol kills a lot of people. Guns are used improperly and to kill people. Marijuana might kill a few people if they drive with it or something like that. Not really for poisoning, but it's not about that at all. It's about instilling public confidence in order to stay at home. And that's what we are seeking to maximize compliance for to be able to reduce the spread of the virus in Colorado.
All right, well, we're going to run in just a minute, but I want to ask you about a call with governors and the president that's had a lot of reporting around it. There was reports of a recording of a call where rural state governors asked President Trump to rush more testing to them. The president reportedly said he had not heard about testing in weeks. Were you on that call? Did you hear the president say that?
I did, you know, and I don't know what he would have heard or hadn't heard. I hear we have a call on testing every day in Colorado. We're working very hard to expand it. I've had a number of calls with the vice president and others requesting that we get more materials for testing. We've already increased our capacity about 10 times from where it started. We just sent out 4,500 tests to our counties last week. And so we're working very hard on the testing. And, you know, the federal government has been a small piece of that. I wish they were a bigger piece of that, but we've been largely figuring out how to do it on our own.
You feel like your relationship with the White House has been productive?
Well, you know, I mean, we, as I said, I wish that they could be doing even more for all states, rural states, urban states. You know, it's a lot that we can do as a nation that as states, we wind up competing against one another and have a harder time doing effectively. But we are certainly operating on the assumption that we have to figure it out ourselves. We're working on acquiring personal protection equipment, scaling up our testing, all of those steps.
That's Governor Jared Polis of Colorado. Governor, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Jared Polis, the Democratic governor of Colorado. Coming up, we'll take a look at two coronavirus patients and what their stories say about response to the virus. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Home Instead Senior Care. Bonnie, a Home Instead caregiver, knows that building trust is essential to forging strong relationships with her Home Instead clients.
I seen the ad in the paper and I called, and 3 days after I was hired, I was with my very first client. You've got to have patience in order to be a good caregiver. You've got to build up the trust. I just love it. I couldn't ask for a better job or a better client.
To learn more or to search for available senior care job opportunities with Home Instead Senior Care, visit homeinstead.com.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or perfect strangers? Get the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle so you can share what you know. On the News Roundup, find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
When the economy goes haywire, Planet Money is here to make sense of it for you. From the big bailouts to the tiny details of a vaccine stockpile.
One of the first things we did was secure a large number of chicken flocks.
So these are like hardworking government chickens?
They are hardworking government chickens.
That's NPR's Planet Money podcast. Listen now.
It's 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. We just spoke with the governor of Colorado, Jared Polis, about what his state is doing to fight coronavirus. Now let's turn our attention to two Americans, one in the South and one in New York City. They both got sick, but not so sick that they had to go to the hospital. One got a test through luck and connections and got a positive diagnosis. The other didn't get tested, but only because doctors told her it was so likely she had coronavirus that testing her would be a waste of resources. Dr. Mike Sogg is the director of the Infectious Disease Division within the University of Alabama at Birmingham School of Medicine. Dr. Sogg, welcome to 1A.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Shannon Keating is a senior culture writer and editor at BuzzFeed. She joins us from Brooklyn in New York. Shannon, welcome.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
How are you feeling, Shannon?
You know, I'm feeling okay. I had a pretty rough weekend, but I'm hopeful that I've kind of turned a corner here.
Well, I'm very glad to hear it. You sound good, and I say that because, well, people who have respiratory distress and difficulty breathing, not only do they not sound good, but sometimes can't talk at all. So you sound great, and it makes me happy because it suggests that you're feeling pretty good. Walk us through your story a little bit, Shannon. When did you begin to suspect that you might be infected with coronavirus?
Sure. So I live in Brooklyn in a house with three other roommates. And about 3 weeks ago, one of my roommates just started exhibiting all the telltale symptoms. She had a low-grade fever. She had the dry cough and just was feeling generally really crappy. And from that point on, we were thinking, it seems like she was.
Shannon's line is a little bit shaky. We'll get her back. But Dr. Sogg, you're here. Dr. Sogg, how are you feeling?
I'm about well now, thanks.
Yeah, good to hear. Dr. Sy, do you mind if I ask how old you are?
I'm 64.
So when you first felt an onset of symptoms, you're also an expert, there's that too. When you first felt an onset of symptoms, what was your thinking process like?
Oh, I was pretty confident I had it. And I think one of the messages here is that I did everything I knew to do to keep from picking this up, and the frequent hand washing, the social distancing, and it wasn't enough. This virus is very infectious.
Yeah, I mean, you're a expert director of the infectious diseases division. You didn't have to be told what to do to stop yourself getting a virus. I mean, you've spent your career doing that.
Right, and the symptoms are very variable. I will say this, that it's absolutely nothing like the flu to start with. The flu, you get all at once. You feel terrible within an hour of onset of symptoms. This is kind of creeps, and you get a little bit of cough, a little bit of headache, a little bit of feeling bad, and that persists over a day or two or three. And then in my case, I thought I was well after day four or five, and then boom, every night from that point forward for the next 8 nights, it was fever, chills, cough, a lot of misery. Mm. And in the case of being a physician, I would sit there and know exactly what I hope didn't happen, and that is shortness of breath and the inability to talk like you were just describing. That never happened to me, fortunately.
Good. Glad to hear it. But that slow creep that you describe, it strikes me that has public health implications, that slow creep. I mean, we talk about asymptomatic people being able to spread coronavirus, but that slow creep, gosh, that might keep you saying, you know, oh, one more trip to the grocery store. Oh, I could take one more day at work, you know?
That's exactly right. Both points you made are spot on, that some people don't have any symptoms at all. And only way we're going to know that they ever were infected was with an antibody test. And that should be coming out in the next month or so. That's just looking at the tracks of the virus that have been present, but the patient wasn't symptomatic. But the other point is key. As soon as someone develops any kind of symptom, they should quarantine themselves. If they're living with roommates, they should cordon themselves off. If they think about going to the grocery, they just stop. Don't get out of the house and call your provider. That's very, very important.
All right, Dr. Sag, hold the line. I think we have Shannon back. Shannon, are you there?
I am here. Hi.
Great. So you have housemates at your place there in Brooklyn. Your roommate got very sick. You started to get very sick. At what point did it dawn on you that, hey, this is probably the virus that everybody's talking about?
Probably a little bit over a week ago when I started thinking that maybe my chest pains and shortness of breath couldn't only be attributable to anxiety, but I found just through my reporting, but also just through friends that I've talked to, that it's really hard, I think, to distinguish between what might be the signs of panic or anxiety from actual physical symptoms of this virus, especially if you have it on the more mild end, which I think I have. But between the headaches, I developed a cough, and just a general feeling of very deep fatigue, it really could have felt like nothing else I've ever had before. So I have to think that I have it, especially because we didn't quarantine ourselves off early enough in the process with my roommate, who has a positive test, and it seems likely to be the case, but it is a little strange not to really know for sure, even
right.
though I'm self-isolating as if I...
Now, definitely likely, but of course you're hedging, Shannon, because your roommate has a positive diagnosis. What happened when you went to try to get tested yourself?
So I messaged with a doctor who told me that I was likely exhibiting symptoms. They said, if my roommate has it and these are the kinds of symptoms I have, I likely do have it. And I was given the option of, if I really wanted to, going into Manhattan, getting my lungs tested, or getting an x-ray, or maybe even getting a test. But I was kind of put in the position of thinking, okay, I don't need one. Like, I have enough knowledge at hand, and I know I'm not a severe enough case that I can just treat myself as if I do have it. But it is a little strange to to see that even though, I mean, with my roommate, even when she actually got the test back, we were all expecting it, but it was still somehow a little bit surprising, you know, to have that, like, the real actual confirmation, because testing is still so limited.
And I would guess it brings something home in the most intimate way that's, you know, you're a journalist just like me. Things are on the news. You cover them. You're sort of dispassionate. When it comes home, not only into your house, but into your very body, that's literally, that's a different story. Dr. Sag, you got tested. Did you get tested because you're an infectious disease physician and you knew who to ask? How did it work?
Yeah, for me, that's exactly what happened. And I'm not trying to claim some sort of privilege here. I just knew who to call and how to ask. But I think in Shannon's case, the advantage of knowing for sure is that once you have had it and you survive it, you should be immune for the rest of your life, or at least for the next several years to this. So I think it's really important to know for sure if you had it. So it may be a little bit too late to be tested in Shannon's case, but if it could get done, at least with an antibody, at least then you would know you have some degree of protection from this point forward.
Now, we were talking about this very dynamic on the show yesterday with a friend of mine who's a journalist who wrote about the opportunity cost of not knowing if he and his wife were positive for coronavirus, because he said if we knew that, we could be out in the world helping others and doing that thing where you get society moving again instead of sequestering ourselves. Shannon, do you have that feeling? I mean, I don't know if there's any sense of relief for you. If you're pretty sure you had it and the good Dr. Sag says you're probably immune, man, you feel like you're sort of through the doorway, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's 100% right, but it feels as though, I mean, I would love our house kind of has dreams of becoming a little, you know, immunity cell and being able to actually go out in the world and help, knowing that we're immune. But it definitely feels weird to be in that kind of nowhere zone. One of my roommates who's recovered now has reached out to Mount Sinai in hopes of donating blood so that we can get her serum tested. So I am hoping that eventually all of us might be able to get antibody tests so that we know for sure. But yeah, I'm not sure how much longer that really is, especially in New York.
But Dr. Sag, this antibody test would tell Shannon that she has the antibodies, but there's no way to know right now whether she or you would be immune from reinfection or for how long, right?
Correct. We don't know 100%. The best guess, and I'll underscore that word, guess, is that once you've had this infection, you will be immune for at least a year or two or three, maybe lifetime. It's hard to know. But the antibody would be a great metric, a great marker of whether or not that immunity exists and how profound the immunity is.
So, Dr. Sag, take just 1 second before we have to go. What did this experience teach you? Not only as an infectious disease expert, but also as a patient and somebody who is able to get a test?
Well, I've been very fortunate my whole life. I've never had a serious illness. This is my first. And while I've had what I would call empathy for patients, I think most people in infectious diseases in particular are very prone to relate to what their patients are going through. Having gone through this firsthand, I see what it's like on the other side of the exam table, at least metaphorically. And it really helps to know what that's like. And I think it's going to make me a better provider in the long run. One other thing I'll add quickly is that even
though
I think
I have... Real quick, Dr. Sag, we got to run.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, that's all right. You can hold that thought.
Just real quickly, even though I think I have immunity, that doesn't mean I don't use protective equipment in the hospital.
Yes, indeed. And so many healthcare workers are clamoring for that protective equipment as well. That's Dr. Mike Sag, the director of the Infectious Disease Division at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Dr. Sag, thank you.
Thank you.
And Shannon Keating, senior culture writer and editor at BuzzFeed. Shannon, thanks to you.
Thanks so much.
We'll have more, including our daily act of kindness and a special message from me right after this. It's 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Hey, Mindy here from the Wow in the World science podcast for kids and families. If you're looking for fun ways to educate and entertain your kids, we've got you covered 5 days a week. On Mondays, go on a scientific adventure with Wow in the World. And Tuesdays through Fridays, play along with our new game show, To What's in a Wow. It's Wow in the World from Tinkercast and NPR. Subscribe and listen now.
Well, before we take off for the day, it's of course time for today's act of kindness. Ever since this coronavirus epidemic started, we've been asking you for moments of kindness and empathy and solidarity from your communities. Today's story is from Deborah, who's in Denver, Colorado.
We were walking in our neighborhood. We live in a very sweet little neighborhood in the big city. And we came upon a sidewalk chalk drawing with a message that said, "Be well, stay safe, and keep learning," LERNING, which made it particularly adorable. It was all decorated with rainbows and flowers and little stars and the mountains. It was just quite sweet. And the little girl who drew it is named Grace. And I just wanted to say thank you, Grace, and for everybody that's doing small, kind things like this. It made us smile and brightened our day.
Deborah, I love that story, and it makes me smile, too, because my niece in Oregon does that exact thing. She draws on the sidewalk with chalk to tell people to bear up, and she draws hearts on the sidewalk for people who are on their walks. I love it. We want your acts of kindness and empathy. You can send them to us each day, 855-236-1212. You can leave a message with our free app, 1A Vox Pop, and we'll put your voices on the air each day. One more note from me. Today is my last day hosting here on 1A, and I want to say it's been an absolute privilege spending these last several months with you. We've had some great conversations between us about impeachment, about politics, books, movies. We even did a show about Yiddish, which I loved every minute of it. It's been a special honor to help bring us all together and to get our questions answered, to demand some accountability in this very strange, very difficult, and dangerous time of a pandemic. If you like what you hear on this show, here's who you can thank. The team here at 1A is smart and dedicated, and even when they're working from home, they are tireless. They sweat every detail of what you hear, and it's my honor to have been their voice. They are Aileen Humphreys, Michelle Harvin, Amanda Williams, Haley Blassingame, Matthew Simonson, Emmanuel Johnson, Arfi Getty, Chris Castano, Catherine Fink, Avery Kleinman, James Morrison, Gabrielle Healy, Charlotte Freeland, Katie Klein, Morgan Givens, and Hector Arzate. The engineer is Jake Cherry, with help from Kenny Pirog. Paige Osborne and Daniel Knight are the senior producers who've shown up every day in a pandemic. And Rupert Allman is the executive producer and also my longtime friend. Most of all, this show succeeds because of you, your voice, your calls, your tweets, your input every single day. 1A is at its best when you are part of the conversation. As for me, you can still find me. I'm at Todd Zwillick on Twitter. You can also find me at Vice News. I'll be joining their DC bureau, helping lead their political coverage from coronavirus to the 2020 election and beyond. Tomorrow, you'll be with Sasha Ann Simons, and trust me, you are in very good hands with her. Today's conversations were produced by Amanda Williams, Michelle Harvin, Emmanuel Johnson, Avery Kleinman, and Paige Osborne, and edited by Matthew Simonson. You can learn more about all of them on the website at the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU. It's part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is 1A.